Hi, I'm Bill Brio, and welcome to the podcast. Dave Thomas, one of the original SCTV writers, producers, and stars, is back as my guest. And today we're going to talk about his friend and colleague, Joe Flaherty, who passed away April 1st after a brief illness. Flaherty was 82. For the next hour, one very funny man celebrates another. Coming up next on Brio TV, the podcast. Well, okay, as mentioned, my guest today, Dave Thomas, was a key member of the greatest Canadian TV show ever, SCTV. He later co-starred for 5 seasons on the sitcom Grace Under Fire and had a whole other career writing procedural dramas such as Bones and The Blacklist. You've heard his voice in dozens of animated movies and TV shows, including Animaniacs, Brother Bear, and Family Guy. Shortly after the news broke that Joe Flaherty had died, I reached out to Thomas with condolences and also asked if he might want to share a few memories of Flaherty on a podcast. Thomas got right back to me saying that he would. This conversation was recorded on Monday, April 8, just before a total eclipse of the sun. I thank Dave for his generosity in what had to be an emotional time. Please welcome one of the 5 neat guys, Dave Thomas.
I'm admiring all this amazing stuff behind you, including your Emmy and a skull.
And that's from Bones.
Is it? That's great.
There's another one over there somewhere. But they give you the art department gives you skulls of the injuries in the show that were fatal to the victim. And they're invariably head wounds, the occipital, the parietal, one of those lobes get shattered. I learned all 209 bones of the human body on that show. And the reality of it is it's very, I mean, they have a medical person attached to the staff. So they try to be authentic, you know, to the
right.
Forensic anthropology side of it. I'm talking about it as if it's still in production. Obviously not. But
it ran 12 years, yeah.
Haven't you had Hart Hansen on your show?
Absolutely, yes. Hart, and he and I talked, and he says the best ride in California is in the passenger seat of one of your amazing cars. So... I envy him that. What are they like late 50s Cadillacs?
They're the ones I like. The Cadillacs.
Beautiful.
57 and 58.
Wow.
I don't like 59. It got too showy. The Jetson,
Fins.
The big wing tail and the Jetson rear lights I didn't like. But 57 and 58. This could get noisy here. We got work going on in the house that's just... You know what I mean? It's the kind of thing a younger man would be doing and shouldn't, somebody my age shouldn't be doing.
Okay.
Here we are.
I just moved and moving is hell. So we're not renovating right now, but I feel your pain. So listen, Dave, thank you, first of all, so much for kindly coming back and talking again. I love talking to you. Bill Needle's my favorite TV critic, and you are one of the 5 neat guys. Such a SCTV, I know you've heard this from many people, but that's the best Canadian television show ever. And and I'm sure you've heard this too, and I think it was Conan O'Brien said it, that it was like you guys made a TV show for me and my friends, I think is what he said. And that's how all me and my friends felt when this came on. So thank you again for all of your work on that show.
All right. Well, that's nice of you to say. Thanks.
Now, of course, we're talking, and one of your colleagues has died, Joe Flaherty. And I thank you again. This is, must be a time of grief, and condolences to you and castmates and everybody who knew Joe Flaherty, but let's talk a little bit about that. Where did you first meet Joe Flaherty? Were you on the stage together at Second City?
No, I saw him before I met him. Okay. He was in the first cast of Second City Stage in Toronto on Adelaide Street. And he was instrumental in putting that cast together, actually. He came up from Chicago with Bernie Sons and Brian Doyle Murray and I think Del Close. And they set up a Second City on Adelaide Street. And then it didn't stay open because they couldn't get a liquor license and it wasn't air conditioned. And Toronto audiences don't like that. And in the summer, hot summer months. So it closed in a couple of months. But the work I saw Joe do was brilliant. And the cast that he put together was amazing. Dan Aykroyd, Valerie Bromfield, Jane Eastwood, Jerry Salzberg, who I knew from Godspell, Gilda Radner, and of course, Brian Doyle Murray and Joe himself. Mm-hmm. So I was a copywriter in advertising
right
at the time.
Yeah.
So I saw that show, and that show made me realize this is what I want to do. I don't want to be writing ads. I want to be doing this. But when the show opened again on Lombard Street at the Fire Hall, then it had another cast. This time, Gilda Radner was back, Dan Aykroyd. They added John Candy, Eugene Levy, and Andrea Martin, and Joe was in it. And it was a remarkable cast. And then they made some cast changes to that show. That show was called Alterations While You Wait, and the specific show. Right. And I got a call from Eugene. I was in New York working on ads, and he said, there's a couple openings in the cast. You should get up here and audition. And so I did. And I was lucky enough to get in.
And you took a big pay cut from advertising,
Joe,
right?
Came back. What's that?
You took a big pay cut from the ad world to do that, right?
I did. Yeah, but it didn't matter because I was doing what I loved.
Yeah.
So, you know, when Joe and Eugene and a couple of people from Chicago had gone to Pasadena to open a comedy club there. And it closed pretty quickly. And when Joe came back, he directed the show, that the next Second City show that I did, stage show. This is before SCTV.
Right.
And that's where I really got to know him. And sometimes he would get on stage with us. And he was wildly innovative and unpredictable, which in improv is probably two of the most wonderful things you can be to keep the other cast members amused and delighted. He used to come, when he entered, he would change his name every time. And all the name choices that he came up with were remarkable. I can only remember a couple of them. One was Hudgy De Robertis. So when you enter a scene and announce that your name is Hudgy De Robertis, and you get an immediate laugh from an audience, half the work that you need to do on stage to get laughs is done. They already like you, you know? Yeah. And he was good at that. And then the moves that he made on stage betrayed his skill as both a performer and a writer. Mm-hmm. Because he's writing his own stuff in improv comedy, but he's also performing it. And he was a great actor. So he was able to do things on stage that would take a scene in another direction and make it fun to go along for the ride. And for both the audience and the other players on stage, that's a real skill. And yeah, not very many people have it. And he certainly had it.
You could tell and Dave, your comedy heroes, I understand back then, were more radio guys, right? Like Peter Sellers Bob Hope. Who do you think, who were Flaherty's comedy heroes?
Flaherty knew them all, which I think is a really interesting distinction between what's going on now in comedy, where I've been in modern writing rooms, none of the writers in the room know anything before The Simpsons. And Joe knew everything and went back to Fat Jack Leonard and, you know, people like that that were occasional guests on The Sullivan Show. I knew who he was, but I thought I was the only one who knew who he was, you know. But Joe knew who Fat Jack Leonard was, and he knew all the people from the Second City alumni that had preceded him, which was a pretty remarkable group of people, like Alan Arkin, people like that, Elaine May, Mike Nichols. But Joe's real interest and love affair was with the old films, the film noir movies and things like that. And that informed a lot of his writing and performing that he did on stage, you know. And when we went to do SCTV, it most certainly was where he was coming from. So instead of having somebody like, Milton Berle or Bob Hope or somebody like that as comic idol, he liked Peter O'Toole.
Right.
Not as a comic idol, but just as a great actor that was great to watch, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's ironic that was the first impersonation that was done on SCTV.
Amazing.
Was Joe doing a commercial for Sub-Sahara raising funds as Peter O'Toole. And that, to me, was like opening a door. All of a sudden, I realized, oh, wait a minute. We're this cheap little television show.
Yeah.
And we can't afford guest stars, but we can impersonate guest stars. And Joe opened that door.
He did. So, Gregory Peck, too, early, didn't he?
Yeah, later, though.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
And Charlton Heston and Robert Mitchum. Strange choices. You know what I mean? He wasn't doing the comedians, the impersonations that other comedians were doing.
Yeah.
He was doing those film noir and old B-movie Hollywood stars that he loved.
But Dave, that's what's fascinating in a way, because, you know, what people might think at first, you look back at SCTV, that you guys are basically mining television, that you were goofing on the commercials and the shows and the personalities, but it was broader than that. It was film. It was Ben-Hur. It was Casablanca. And you all, not just one or two of you, had this great love and knowledge of film and combined it in very funny ways, juxtapositioning personalities and voices to create these great memorable sketches, right?
Well, in fairness to your first analysis that we were primarily parodying television, you're right. But television back then, if you'll recall, was a combination of programs, new programs, and old movies.
Right.
Which they ran. There was a station on CHCH in Hamilton, Family Theater, every night at 5 o'clock, old classic movies. And I saw them all, from Wallace Beery movies to all the road movies. They all appeared on CHCH Family Theater. And Joe had a similar exposure in Pittsburgh. And so what happened when we all got together in Toronto was a bunch of like-minded people with similar comic sensibilities met and clicked and found a way of working together to exploit that love and interest of things that we had observed in TV and film that we thought were ridiculous.
It's a great point. I mean, Leonard Maltin has said that television, when he was growing up as well, it was this great museum of films. And so you forget that's where you saw all these great films, is on the Late Show or on the Hamilton 5 o'clock movie. And you're right, it was much more of a, you didn't have to have a special movie channel. They were just on your channels, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there were commercial interruptions, but not like today. There's sometimes when I watch NBC or ABC Nightly News with David Muir, I will see a segment that will, the commercials will end and the segment will start, and it will be less than 15 or 20 seconds before he throws to the next bunch of commercials.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely insane. We used to get a full block of 15 to 20 minutes on Family Theater before they'd interrupt with more commercials, you know? And then typically it would be one 60-second commercial back to the show, as opposed to being bombarded with 20, 15, or 30-second commercials. And television's completely changed. Anyway.
And if you're watching the nightly newscast, those ads that come on, they're all about trying to extend your life. They're all happy people dancing in the sun at a barbecue. And here's how you can live another 6 months with this pill, right?
With long warnings after the sell on the commercial of all the things that can happen and invariably ending with death as the last one.
Yes.
Well, I would consider that a pretty serious side effect.
Yeah.
And worthy of my consideration.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Dave.
That was the playing field that we came into at SCTV. And Joe brought Harold Ramis in because he had worked with Harold in Chicago. And that was a wonderful addition to the writing room for us in the first season. Because right away, just watching the two of them, they had a chemistry that pre-existed and predated SCTV. So it was fun to watch them bounce ideas back and forth. But also, Harold had been Playboy joke editor and had this amazing reference level because he had read everything and was an educated guy, but also remembered what he read. And so it was a delight to watch them, and it was really like going to comedy school. So Harold described me as an unabashed disciple and student in that first season, because I knew a little bit about writing from my experience in advertising, and I knew how to write concisely, because you can tell a lot, you can sell a lot of information in 30 seconds. Yeah. And one of the things that in comedy sketches is probably the biggest vice is people go on too long. And so I brought that to the party. But what I learned from Joe and Harold was this really playful pushing of boundaries and exploration of things that places I'd never thought of going in comedy before. And that was pretty great.
Well, you were
so
certainly,
that when Harold, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say you were a quick study, Dave. I mean, these guys too, Joe was like, 9 years older than you. You probably looked up to these guys just in that way, but within a year, and you were coming from advertising, you'd had some stage experience, but it was you and Joe who were producing the show, right?
Yeah. That the second season, Harold left to do Animal House. And when Harold left, he said, to Andrew Alexander, I think you should make Joe and Dave the head writers in my place. And Andrew said, really? He knew why he would suggest Joe, because Joe was sort of the godfather of our cast and, you know, brought us all along from the stage to the television show. But why he suggested me was kind of baffling to Andrew. And then Harold said, the reason why you should pick Dave is because after 3 or 4 months, Joe's going to quit. And that is exactly what happened.
Oh, no.
And the reason for that is that Joe was not a commodity that could be packaged or run. He was his own guy, and he had his own schedule. He was extremely dysfunctional as someone to work with, but a delight when you could get him. When you could get him, if you wanted Joe to be there at 10 o'clock to start the day, you had to go by his house and pick him up. Otherwise, he wouldn't be there till noon or later.
Back with Dave Thomas after these short messages. What's new on Paramount Plus? Meet A Gentleman in Moscow, premiering exclusively on the streaming service at the end of March. Based on a best-selling novel, the series stars Ewan McGregor as Count Alexander Rostov. The good news? He's spared immediate execution in the aftermath of the Russian Revolution. The bad news, however? He's banished to an attic room in the opulent Hotel Metropole, threatened with death if he ever sets foot outside again. So what's a comrade to do? Rostov enters a whole new world of emotional discovery where he gradually learns the true value of friendship, family, and love. Mary Elizabeth Winstead also stars as glamorous actress Anna Urbanova. And remember, there's a mountain of premium entertainment for audiences of all ages, including programming from Showtime, BET, CBS, Comedy Central, MTV, Nickelodeon, Paramount Pictures, and the Smithsonian Channel, all on Paramount Plus. Well, what's new this month on Super Channel? Well, giddy up for the 11th season of When Calls the Heart, found exclusively in Canada on Super Channel Heart and Home. There are, of course, many burning questions from last season's shocking finale. School teacher Elizabeth, Erin Krakow, she's saddled up with her Mountie man, Nathan Grant, played by former Brio TV podcast guest Kevin McGarry. Can these two ride off into the sunset and still manage parenting obstacles, huh? There are plenty of other obstacles to unravel as Hope Valley heads into the 1920s. Hardys and McGarrys can look forward to 12 new season 11 episodes. And don't forget, all 111 binge-worthy past episodes are available on Super Channel On Demand. Remember, Super Channel, an all-Canadian service, is available via most cable providers across the country, as well as streaming live and on demand with Amazon Prime Video channels and Apple TV Plus. You can also check out Super Channel Plus, available now on the Roku platform in Canada. And we're back with Dave Thomas.
I was reading your book, which, by the way, what a great, great memory of all of this. SCTV Behind the Scenes. You know, you wrote this book quite a few years ago now, but if people can find a copy, wow. And I just read you a quote you got in there about Joe. You said he was a more sophisticated comedy writer than I was.
His instincts and choices were better than mine, but he was an elusive guy, mysterious and introverted in some ways, and it was often difficult to drag the comedy out of him. Is that what you're just describing now, I guess?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely, because he wasn't disciplined. Do you know what I mean? He yeah. would go off, and you'd be writing with him in a room, and you'd focus on the board where we had our cards up and everything, and then you'd look around, he'd be gone. It's like, where the hell did Joe go? You'd be looking for him. Okay. I told this story on our last Zoom call with Joe, and I think Joe was kind of bummed out that I told it. And I didn't mean it disrespectfully at all. I was always surprised and delighted by Joe. And to me, it was always us and them. There was us, the comedy performers and writers who did SCTV. And then there was them, the broadcasters, the producers, the other people on the other side of the rope that, you know, paid us and made it happen, but who didn't play in the same ballpark as us. Well, things got pretty hectic when we were doing the third season of SCTV, and it was difficult. And it was difficult because we didn't have a full cast. Catherine had decided not to do the show for the third season. John was off doing big city comedy. Eugene and Andrea went to LA to audition for sitcoms. And all this had been inspired by the fact that after the second season, Global canceled the show. They'd had enough of us. And the show went down for 6 months to a year before Andrew managed to get it going again. And he got it going with me and Joe and Alarcom in Edmonton,
right,
where Dr. Charles Allard became the deficit financer of the show and provided the facilities that Global had provided. So Joe and I were producers and co-head writers for a few months until Joe packed it in. But then we went out to Edmonton, and it was, I brought Rick Moranis onto the show because I'd met him at a party, and I thought, oh, this guy is a pistol. This guy's a fountain of comedy. We have to have him because we got half a cast, or not even. They're basically just me and Joe. So, and Joe brought Robin Duke and Tony Rosato in, but I brought Rick in, and it was still a ton of work. And Joe's brother, Paul, and Dick Bosucci joined as writers that year. And I think we had Brian Doyle Murray write some sketches too, but part-time, not full-time. So anyway, the shooting schedule was even harder because it was so demanding on the small number of us that you're in at 6 in the morning and you don't get out till 8 or 9 or 10 at night. And then the next day is the same and the same. And on the weekends, it was rehearsals. And it just burned you out. So one day I come into the studio and somebody comes up to me and says, have you seen Joe? And I said, no. And they said, well, we can't find him. And I said, well, did you check the hotel? We're in Edmonton. And they said, yeah, he's not there. In fact, he checked out. What? we're still shooting the show. So I said, if he checked out, then he probably went to Pittsburgh. That's where he was from, you know?
Wow.
So we called his family in Pittsburgh. Now Joe's not there. So it took us a day or two to find out that Joe had gone to Italy.
What?
While we were shooting. And he just had enough. And he didn't want to do it anymore. And it was too crazy. And he came back to the show. The show was very important to Joe. And Joe was absolutely essential to the show. But as I said, he was his own man, you know, and very kind of eccentric and dysfunctional.
That story is like when Ringo quit the Beatles to go to Europe in the middle of the White Album or something, you know, like I guess people in a creative situation under that kind of pressure, sometimes you just have to go to Italy, right?
Yeah. And I laughed at that. I thought that was really funny. We had to recast. It was a lot of work. You know, we had to recast some of his roles, and I'm sure I got grumpy about it in some cases, but mostly I thought it was really funny because I thought, well, you know what? I wish I was in Italy with him.
Yeah. You mentioned that this story you told at a recent Zoom call with Joe, and I understand that all of you gathered on Zoom in Joe's final weeks. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, it was the second last one that I mentioned this. Wow. I wasn't able to make the last Zoom call because we had a family trip planned and I went with the family. I regret that now, but I couldn't cancel it because it was all paid for. But anyway, I phoned Joe before I left and talked to him for about 20 minutes. And he seemed pretty strong and, you know, not fully healthy and vigorous like he used to be. But, you know, I didn't think he was going to die. Mm. And then we went to Hawaii. And then when I came back, we got off the plane on Thursday and I got a text from his daughter. And it just said, my dad passed away. Mm-hmm. My dad. Or dad passed away. Three words. And I remember sitting at the, staring at my phone in the car. We were leaving the airport. And Kim was sitting beside me. And I just showed her the phone. And she put her, I had tears streaming down my cheeks. Mm-hmm. And what was probably the most distressing, Bill, about that was that all the memories, all the laughs, all the fun, everything was now condensed into three words. Dad passed away. And that was it. That was all that was left of Joe at that particular moment. That was devastating. And I just, look, I understand life. I nearly kicked the bucket in 2020 when I got sepsis and was in the hospital for 4 months. But I got to tell you, we're all about being here. And we're at a party. And then when you die, you leave the party. But the party goes on. And that's the part of it that I knew when I looked at that text from his daughter Gudrun. It was that there'll be the emails and there'll be the phone calls and then there'll be a funeral and a memorial, and then people will go back to business as usual, and that'll be the way that goes, and it'll just be the memories. That's all you got. And I cherish those memories, but I want to remember them all. You know what I mean? I don't want to just lionize Joe as this guy that I did stuff with that I'm very proud of, but also the dysfunctional, crazy guy that I had so much fun trying to corral. That's funny. And that, you know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely.
One of my theories about comedians is that being funny isn't a talent, it's a condition. Most of the people I know who are funny are crazy.
Right.
In some way. And it's usually something that began in puberty where they weren't accepted by their peers or they were too fat or too homely or not athletic or whatever. Whatever it is that isolates you in high school from other people and makes you the brunt of jokes. So you develop a defensive technique of making other people laugh to get the focus off you, you know?
Well, Dave, I think you know Ron James, the comedian.
Of course.
Yeah, so Ron once said to me that, you know, a contractor's house is never finished, a comedian's house isn't always funny, right? So,
sure. And yeah. By the way, funny people can be unfunny.
Yeah.
But unfunny people can never be funny.
You're right.
I really believe that.
You are so right. And just Flaherty talking about him, to me, just as strictly as a viewer, there's something about his voice. When you heard the tone or timbre or whatever it was, it was naturally funny. It made you ready to laugh, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you could tell the sort of unpredictability in his tone, where you don't know where this guy's going to go. So you got to listen carefully. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And that was an essential part of him, was that, God, he was unpredictable in every way. Huh. And that, to me, made him delightful and so lovable. And
unforgettable. Probably be
the part that I miss the most.
Well, I just think to what you were saying earlier about, you know, you get this devastating news, you're in a car, it has to be terrible. A good friend of mine passed away about a year ago. I've known from high school. We'd see each other every summer at the cottage and stuff. Dave, think of him all the time. But, you know, I do feel that all the great craziness of Dave stays with me, especially when I'm with other friends who knew Dave, right? Like, you do carry that. It's they're not here, but there's something about them having been part of your life that never goes away, you know?
You know, when Marty Short's wife, Nancy, died, people were kind of trepidatious about talking about her. It was around Marty, you know. And Marty made it really clear. He said, no. Talk about her. I don't want to forget her. I want to remember her.
Yeah.
So let's not avoid talking about Nancy. Let's talk about her. Marty is probably one of the few people who I think understands death better than anyone.
Yeah.
And when I first met Marty, he was 19. He was living in the family home by himself. His father had just died. His mother had died 2 years before that. And his older brother, David, had died in a car crash a year or two before that. So here's this little guy sitting in his family house by himself. And yet he was the most life-affirming and positive and happy person that I ever met. And I asked him at that time, and I remember this because we've discussed it since, I said, why, if anybody has a right to be miserable, you do. Why are you so happy? And he said, well, I can't choose the things that happen to me because they just happen. I can only choose the way I react. He said, they're gone and I am continuing to go on. So I can go on happy or I can go on miserable. He said, I just choose to go on happy. Now, that was when I was in English Lit. I was looking for a deeper answer than that. And I was really unsatisfied with it and thought that was a stupid and trivial answer until I got older and realized how profound it was.
Yeah.
And, man, that's part of what life is you realize how stupid you are as you get older. And how all the things you thought you knew when you were younger are things that you're actually not so sure about when you get older and better able to judge them, you know? So
I don't know if you've seen the new documentary on Steve Martin. There's a two-part Apple TV, I think it's called Steve !Martin, a documentary in two pieces. And the last half of it is up to date, and you see them working on Martin Short working on Only Murders and Things. But it strikes me from, and I don't know Steve Martin at all, maybe you do, but from what I've heard from other folks is, and in reading his book, he wasn't the what's the word, happiest guy a lot of times. You know, he had his demons, and it was, you know, he's a perfectionist and different things. But it just seems him being paired with Martin Short is going to extend Steve Martin's life. Because Martin Short, as you point
out. Without a doubt.
Yeah, right? He's
without
just.
Without a doubt.
Right?
Being with Marty extends anyone's life. He's such a life force.
Yeah.
You know, we all know that about him. We all love that about him. Mm. He's got more energy than all of us combined. And he's still going at it and growing. I mean, I thought Marty was funny when I first met him. But when I watched that show, Jiminy Glick, and saw him literally steamrolling everybody in the world of comedy, nobody could top him. Nobody was faster.
No.
And he was in this character, and he would just nail them, you know? And that's Marty. He's just always growing. He's probably the best talk show guest I've ever seen.
Ever.
You know? Didn't
you go on Jiminy Glick as Bob Hope?
Yeah, and I had to pretend to die to get some attention. Because Marty was wiping the floor with me. You know?
Yeah. Very funny. I think one of the funniest things I ever saw, Dave, was you doing Andrew Dice Hope at Just for Laughs. I'll never forget that. That was
I wasn't happy about doing that either, I got to tell you.
It made me laugh, man.
But there's a funny story attached to that that probably doesn't belong in this tribute to Joe, but it seems to extend it to a wider area. I said I would do Andrew Dice Hope if and only if I could do Bog Man, which was a 12th century British comedian that had been found in a peat bog. And so I got the guy who made the costumes for Michael Jackson's Thriller to make me this costume of like a bog man pulled out of a peat bog with removable fingers and things like that. And I was at a club, you know, Just for Laughs, there's the main stage, and then there's these satellite clubs that run all through Montreal.
Yeah.
And
Saint-Denis.
So I was supposed to do Bogman at this club, and just the act just before me was somebody named Rocket Man. And I thought, oh man, Bogman, Rocket Man, I wish I wasn't following Rocket Man. Well, it didn't end there. Rocket Man's act was, he was some British guy. He took all his clothes off, everything, stuck a flare up his ass, lit it, and ran around the stage with a lit flare in his ass.
Nice. Now,
okay, so the audience is appalled at first, but by the time that flare started to burn down, they were laughing hysterically. And then his act ended, and now, ladies and gentlemen, Bogman. I couldn't have had a worse act to follow. If you know what I mean, I remember telling Joe about that, and Joe laughed his head off because he understood the insanity of it. You know,
were you tempted to light something or drop your trousers? No. Or
no, I was so stunned that I just continued my act as Bogman and tanked. Just totally bombed. It sucked. It was no good. But anyway.
Well, I wanted to ask as well about the 2018 reunion at the St. Elgin or the Elgin Theater in Toronto. You guys were all on stage with Jimmy Kimmel. I was there that night. It was like high mass sitting there. It was just incredible. It was just electric. And, you know, they even had the crane from Johnny LaRue's crane shot in the auditorium, right? That was just tremendous and beautiful. So it was cool to see Joe as part of that. and all of you. And that must have been a meaningful gathering for you as well, right?
Oh, yeah, for all of us. But it still hasn't aired.
Well, Dave.
Nor probably will it ever.
Okay.
The irony of it is, that was a sore spot for Joe.
Yeah.
Because there was a real sort of a evolution of things where it took a while to put it together. And first we were going to do some movie parodies that Scorsese was going to direct. Then some people didn't want to do that. And then there was really no agreement in the cast as to what we could do or should do. And I think Joe was particularly frustrated by that, because the legacy of SCTV at that point was really important to him. And I'm sure that he was aware the central and seminal role he had played in founding and forming SCTV.
Yeah.
And then being there right through the, after Catherine and Rick and I had left, and ultimately John left. And then it was just Joe, Eugene, Andrea, and Joe, Eugene, Andrea. That's it. It was just the three of them at the end with some new players like Mary Charlotte Wilcox and people like that. So Joe was there from the very beginning to the very end, and I think he felt bad, particularly bad, that Scorsese show didn't become more and then ultimately wasn't aired.
I don't know. I mean, I know Netflix and CTV were in on this. Why don't they just show that gathering as a TV show? I mean, it seems like
the footage is with Scorsese still.
Mm.
And I don't know how many more Flower Moon movies he has to make before he actually gets to it. But that was a sore spot for Joe. And he really wanted to see that show air. And I think he would have been delighted if it could have aired in his lifetime.
Right. Yeah, no, should have. Now it looks like the only reunion might be on Only Murders in the Building, right? The way things are going, you got Eugene Levy is shooting scenes now in New York, I guess, for that. Are we going to see you on there? Is there?
Andrea did it and Eugene did it.
Right.
I don't think so. I'm pretty much done with performing. I don't. First of all, they haven't invited me to do it. And secondly, I'm sure that I want to go to New York and shoot a show. And just the process of it. I got offered a movie in Ireland. And it was an okay part. And it was an interesting movie. A real sort of lifestyle type film, small budget. And then I just called the producer and said, I can't do it. He said, is it schedule? Is it money? We can find some more money. And I said, you know what? I have to tell you that the reason is I'm in my 70s now. And the thought of getting on an airplane, being at an airport, lining up with security, flying for 10 hours, then going to some hotel that I don't know what the bed is like, and being in a trailer, having somebody knock on the door at 2 in the morning, we're ready for you on set, Mr. Thomas. I'm just like, give me a break. I said, I just don't want to do it. I'm sorry to be that, but that's the honest answer.
Mm.
And he said, thank you for that honest answer, Dave. He said, I totally understand that, you know.
Yeah,
and
good for you.
And that's where I am with performing now. I used to be, I was dying to perform. I loved it. But I don't really
It was fun. It was fun to see you on like Arrested Development, or you know, like it was these little great performances. Really, were fun for fans, right?
Well, they called me about that, and they said, I knew the guys running it, Jimmy Valley and Mitch.
Yeah,
Hurwitz. And they said, yeah, we've got like half a dozen shows. You're playing Charlize Theron's uncle. And am I pronouncing your name right, Charlize Theron?
I think so, yeah.
I thought, well, how bad could that be?
Right.
And she turned out to be delightful and really a pro.
Mm.
And so that was good, but I was starting to lose my interest in it at that point, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I had a wedding. My wife's brother was getting married in Hawaii. And so I had to get a hard out in my contract with Fox. Well, they don't like to do that. They don't want to give you hard outs because if production goes longer, then you're able to get out, and then they got to figure out how do we replace him or right. get him back or what. But I managed to get it, and sure enough, we get to the Friday where I was going to be leaving for the wedding on the weekend, and Jimmy Valley and Mitch come to my trailer and they say, what do we have to do to get you to come? We need you on Monday to shoot. And I said, I'm done. I got a hard out. I'm done. I'm gone. And anyway, they finally bribed me with a lot of money. And I flew out, I think, Sunday night or Sunday morning and shot the next day. And I was home that same day, and some of the people in the wedding party didn't even know I was gone.
Amazing. Isn't that crazy? It was fun to see Joe Flaherty later too, pop up in films and, you know, working with, on Freaks and Geeks and yeah. movies as well. Right. And always, yeah, and even if he was just for 120 seconds, it was the best part of whatever it was.
And even, here's a classic example. Joe's character in Happy Gilmore is such a small, in terms of airtime, role, but so memorable.
Yeah.
That just that you, what you're saying about Joe's voice, that it's, there's something in the timbre of his voice that mm-hmm. is immediately funny. When Joe was calling him a jackass from the sidelines, it was making me laugh.
Right.
Because it was just so funny. And obviously Adam Sandler thought it was funny, too.
Yeah.
He did this tribute to Joe.
Yeah, he sure did.
He passed away. And I thought that was very nice.
We'll be back with Dave Thomas after this short break. Well, time once again to speak with Sweet Emily Gagné from Hollywood Suite. Emily, how are you today?
I'm great, Bill.
Oh, I don't know. I saw your banners. I saw the ads. It looked kind of scary, this one show. What's going on?
Yeah, it's called Until I Kill You, and it is a UK true crime drama that tells the story of Delia Balmer, who survived a bunch of violent attacks from her boyfriend, John Sweeney, who was, spoiler alert, a murderer. So if you're into true crime stuff and you're into UK dramas, this is for you. And this show is available on demand right now. But if you want to tune in week to week like old school, you can do that starting April 18th.
All right. Now, what if you're like me, you're scared of shows with a title where people get killed? What else you got?
Well, you know what? We've got the new season of A Year in Film, which is our original series, which is about different iconic years in cinema. So we're talking about 1977 this year. So that's like Star Wars, Close Encounters, Slapshot, Eraserhead. Also, 1988, personal favorite year of mine, Beetlejuice, Child's Play, Working Girl, Coming to America, 1991, 2000. So these are all just, you know, film experts talking about the iconic films of these years.
I saw Star Wars and Annie Hall the day they opened in 1977. So I'm going to want to tune into that one for sure.
You are. And it's going to be April 11th is that first episode at 9 p.m. And then the rest of the episodes will premiere the following days, the 12th, 13th, and 14th.
All right. Fantastic. Go back to the days of my youth, 1977, with Hollywood Suite this month. See you, Emily.
Thank you, Bill.
Here he is again. Dave Thomas, do you have a favorite character that Joe Flaherty did, or whether it was original one or one of the impersonations? Or there's so many of them to choose from, obviously.
I remember there was a series of scenes that Eugene wrote called Days of the Week.
Right.
It was a soap opera.
Yeah.
And Joe played this guy named Rocco
right.
in the soap opera. Now, playing a stupid character is like a dangerous trap for a comedian because you can be too broad. And Joe's Rocco was so stupid, but so brilliantly performed that that's my favorite thing that he did in all of SCTV.
I remember when he would be on Half Wits as Arthur Liggett.
Yeah. Where,
you know, that to me, again, with that big putty nose.
Yeah. But that was much broader than Rocco. Rocco right. was dramatically funny.
Yeah.
And it was, you know what I mean? Watching him and Candy plot together was one of my favorite moments in that. It was pretty great.
That sketch he did with Candy going down the road was pretty damn great.
Yeah, that was good too. Yeah.
Were there ones that you guys did together? Did you do, I know you were the five neat guys, but were there others where you were working opposite Joe in particular?
Well, Joe could do Peter O'Toole.
Right, right.
And when he introduced that impersonation, then that caused me to jump in because I could do Richard Harris. And so then the man who would be king of the popes was born.
Yeah.
And that sketch, we then did How the Middle East Was Won and a bunch of these things with sort of British characters. And I had a lot of fun with Joe because we were... We were each competing to blow each other off the screen with our impersonations. We specifically had this little game going. And John Candy played Burton. And
right.
John was very nervous about playing Burton because he didn't know how to do it. You know, he couldn't do an impersonation of Richard Burton. And Joe just said, just go, whoa, whoa, whoa. Because that's what Burton does. He goes, whoa, whoa, snort and go, whoa. So Joe and I are doing our O'Toole and our Richard Harris trying to blow each other off the screen. And John comes out with his Burton, whoa, whoa, and blows us off. Just walked away with it just like that, you know.
There was a bit of Ralph Cramden in that Burton.
Yeah.
It was pretty damn funny. Yeah, you as Harris singing that, well, I left the cake out in the rain song for 45 minutes. I mean, that was pretty funny.
I met Richard Harris,
and he
was not happy.
Oh, really?
No.
But really, what did he say? What did he say? Don't do that again?
He actually pushed me physically.
Really?
Yeah, pushed me away physically. He said, I saw that. I heard about it, but I didn't see it. And it was evident that he had seen it from the way he was talking, you know. And I just, and then he was pushing me and I was looking at his hand and looking at him and I was going, what, am I going to get into it with a famous British pub brawler here? I don't think so.
Did you ever meet Michael Caine? Did he come after you with his bloody hand?
I never met him. But I'll tell you, I met Cronkite, which was amazing.
Oh, wow, really? Okay.
And here's what happened there. We did this thing called Murder in the Cathedral, where Cronkite presented it. And because of his love of space, he did it in zero gravity with astronauts in spacesuits. And the acolytes were astronauts. And everybody, it was just a very bizarre concept. And I played Walter Cronkite throwing to this from the book, from a studio. And Rick Moranis played Brinkley in the lobby interviewing the patrons who got bored and walked out, which included Katharine Hepburn, played by Katharine O'Hara.
Yeah.
And Joe, who played Tom Wolfe, which was a bizarre impersonation, right? For somebody to do.
Yeah.
So anyway, years later when I did the new show, Buck Henry was friends with Walter Cronkite. And he said, I got a surprise for you. Now, I must set this up by saying that at the very end of this Murder in the Cathedral thing, Cronkite and Brinkley get together on the actual set. And they I said, this would be funny if we end with the two of us going sailing with a couple of babes. And and we got these drop dead gorgeous models, and Rick as Brinkley said, Walter, this is Danielle and Tracy and nice to meet you. And how do you feel like going sailing? Because I'd heard that Walter Cronkite had a sailboat and loved to go sailing. So cut to years later, I meet Cronkite in New York and with Buck Henry. And Cronkite is saying to me, I saw that piece. And he said, what was the thing about the two women at the end? And I said, he said, what was your reason for doing that? And I said, okay, look, I'm sorry. We just thought it would be funny if the two of you had a couple of hot young babes that you decided to go sailing with. And Cronkite looks at me, he says, you have no idea the amount of flack I had to deal with at home because of that.
Oh, that's hilarious. That's funny. You got Walter Cronkite in trouble. To me, Buck Henry and Walter Cronkite, that's like Wally Cox and, the great actor from The Godfather there as best friends. You just don't see those two together, right?
No. And, Gore Vidal and Richard Belzer. I had lunch with them at the Chateau Marmont.
Really?
And it's like, this is the kind of stuff that happens, right, in our comedy careers is we end up rubbing shoulders with the strangest people.
Yeah,
you know,
that's amazing. I saw Walter Cronkite. I was with the TV critics in Pasadena at one of the TCAs, and Walter Cronkite was in his 90s, and he gave a, it was supposed to be at a half hour session, and it went an hour, and all of us, you could hear a pin drop. We just sat there. It was fascinating, and he was a funny man. He had a sense of humor.
Oh, yeah.
Great sense of himself. It was just one of the most memorable press sessions I've ever been at. It's really cool.
Yeah. And, Marty Short is good friends with Tom Brokaw.
Wow.
I mean,
yeah.
Come on.
I don't know.
Where does that fit in the lexicon of relationships,
Speaking of meeting your heroes, you met Bob Hope on a few occasions, and I read your book, one of them, the first, I think, was in 1964 at the CNE. I guess he was doing a show
That's right.
And you ran down after the show to try to catch a glimpse of him?
I ran down after the show onto the field of the CNE.
Right.
You know how big that space is.
Enormous.
He was on the stage, and his limo was there, and he was just being loaded into his limo, and I really ran fast. I could run that. And got him just as he got in. And my friend who was running with me shook hands with him first, and then I shook his hand, but he tried to close my hand. He started closing the window while I was shaking hands with him. And cut to years later, I meet him at the Playboy Gorge Club when Andrea, Catherine, Marty, and I are opening for him at the Playboy Gorge Club in New Jersey. It's closed now.
Wow.
And he's walking along with his entourage. And we're there, and I said, hey, it's Bob Hope. And so I walked up to him and positioned myself just, and I just said, hey, Bob. And I started walking in stride with him because he kept walking. And I said, you know, I first met you in, I think, 1964 at the CNE in Toronto. And you tried to close my hand in your power window. And he says, well, I must have been in a big hurry. And I said, like you are now, Bob? And he stopped. He stopped and he looked at me and he said, no, I'm not in that big of a hurry. Who are you? What's your name? And so I told him my name and I told him who we were and what we were doing. And anyway, yeah.
Hope. Fantastic.
I was at his house. I spent quite a bit of time with him. Became friendly with his daughter. And, you know, to circle back to today's subject of Joe's passing.
Yeah.
When Dolores and Linda were at Bob's deathbed, he was 100. And Dolores said, Bob, you have a choice. You could be buried in Arlington, or because they've arranged that, or wow. in the family crypt out here in the San Fernando Valley. And Bob looks at him and he says, I don't know, why don't you surprise me?
Arlington would be reserved for war heroes generally, right? That's the my goodness.
Because of all the shows he did for the military, they managed to arrange that. But that's a funny thing for somebody to say on their deathbed, don't you think?
It's a great line, because he's Bob Hope. But yeah. You did Hope on that great Dave Foley's True Meaning of Christmas specials, which Joe Flaherty also took part in. Yeah, that is one of the funniest scenes is you guys in that, with you reading the cue cards and Flaherty with the big ears doing Bing, mocking David Bowie. It's a wonderful moment in that special. It's very, very funny. Do you remember shooting that? Were you there with Flaherty the same day?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And Joe was really hilarious because he focused on those ears. That was Bing's Achilles heel. He had these big ears,
right.
And they stuck out.
Yeah.
And, you know, Joe was very observant, and so he would focus on stuff like that, you know.
Yeah,
it made me laugh.
No, they were they were like the suicide doors on the old Lincolns. Yeah. And
that's right.
Listen, Dave, thank you so much. You're so generous with your time. I wanted to ask too. Said Red, you got another project? Are you working on something with your son? Did I get that correct? Yeah. Tell me about the Orange. Is that
that's it?
That sounds pretty funny. What's the premise?
The premise is about it's a dramatically it's a kind of a comedy drama. You know, I mean, today I challenge anyone to find a joke or a funny moment in that show, The Bear, that won all the awards as a comedy.
Right.
I mean, there isn't one funny moment in that whole series.
Right.
So, but comedy is defined by its length now. It's a half hour. So this has got more drama in it, but it's definitely got comedic turns. It's about a Canadian family that witnesses a gangland bombing, a bombing one of their rivals' clubhouses. And so in testifying, the son gets threats from the gang, and so the RCMP puts the whole family in the witness protection program, and they have to go to the UK, to a little town called Rye in England. And so we sold this to BBC Studios first. We pitched it to them, and they loved it. Wow. Then we took it to CBC, and then CBC developed it for a year. We wrote a couple of scripts for them, and then they passed. And then Amazon Canada said that they were interested in the show. So now it looks like we might be able to do it.
And oh, that's so great.
Yeah, we're very, very excited about it.
Well, good luck. It'd be fun to work with your son. I imagine that's pretty cool, right?
Yeah, it is.
He's an actor.
He was on Better Call Saul.
Yeah.
He was on Banshee. Both were recurring roles. And then a bunch of other television shows and some movies like the Stanford Prison Experiment. So he's got some good credits. But I said to him, you got to write. You can't be sitting by your phone waiting for somebody to call you as an actor. Mm-hmm. Write your own stuff.
That's so good advice.
He took that seriously. And this show is his idea. So
that's great.
Yeah, I'm excited to be able to work with him and help him on it.
Very cool. Have you seen Eugene's show, The Reluctant Traveler?
I have.
And
that's hilarious.
Isn't it?
Oh, seeing Eugene on a dog sled is worth the price of admission just in itself. I mean, that's hysterically funny to me.
Did you know he was half Scotch?
Yes, of course. I knew his mom.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean,
sure.
I joked with
him. My mother was Scottish, and Eugene's mother was Scottish.
My mother, too. From Glasgow. Yeah, no, I mean.
There you go. And Gene's mother.
Yeah.
So that's a real common bond.
I told Gene, I interviewed him, and I said, so you're half Scotch and half water. And he kindly laughed, as you're doing now.
Well, his mother's name was Betty, and my mother's name was Maureen. And I think Betty and Maureen actually met a couple of times, too.
Wow, that's cool.
But, yeah.
My mom's Margaret, and she's still with us at 99, knocking wood here.
They can outlive us all, those Scots. My mom made it to 93.
Yeah, they're stubborn.
Don't
want to
go.
Listen, Dave, thank you so much for your time today and being so generous with these stories. It's just always a pleasure. And please say hi to Hart Hansen. Have you read his book? His new
I haven't, not yet.
Yeah, neither have I. It's just coming out. I've got to get a copy.
I'll get a copy.
He's a good.
But I read pretty much everything he writes.
Yeah.
And I just haven't read this.
And
he's
yourself.
So prolific.
He is.
He's fast.
Are you working on another book? I know you've written as well, right?
You know, I've got I've got about 225 pages of 300 done, and I just kind of got stuck. I haven't figured out how I want to finish it. And it's been sitting like that for a year. So I don't know. I hope I get it finished.
Well, that's getting close to the finish line. But best of luck with The Orange. Dying to see that on Amazon and on the BBC. And congratulations.
Yeah, you probably can't plug it yet because it's in development. And, you know, executives get very, very testy if their bosses see media where they're committing to something, you know.
Well, I can still look forward to it. How's that? We'll just leave it at that.
That's wonderful, Bill.
Okay.
Thank you.
Dave, thank you so much, and have a great day. The sun is about to be blocked by the moon up here. Are you getting this eclipse?
Oh, you're getting
a
full eclipse there, aren't you?
Yeah. So
Don't you think it's kind of interesting how people are regressing over this eclipse?
Yeah.
It's almost like people are becoming troglodytes and reverting to their Stonehenge earlier selves.
Yeah, it's not like it's an apocalypse. It's just an eclipse. No. Yeah.
It's okay. The moon is moving in front of the sun.
But it is it is only every 60 years. And my dad lived a long life, too. I used to joke that whenever Kohoutek or Halley's Comet went up, he didn't even look up anymore. You know, like it was, oh, yeah, that thing. Tired of that.
Yeah.
It's just about to get pitch dark here. So, and it's not happening where you are?
Nope. We're not in the corridor, so to speak.
Okay.
Apparently Hamilton's right in the middle of it.
Yeah, I think so. It's going to go right over McMaster, where your old alma mater. So there you go. Thank you again. And
good to talk to you, Bill.
You too, Dave. Take care.
My thanks to Dave Thomas, and once again, condolences to the family of the late, great Joe Flaherty. Thanks, as always, to producer Phil Hong, who has more command of media production than even Jerry Todd. My thanks again to BJ Del Conte, Paul Boudre, and the Crispy Critters, as well as my old pal Steve Dudley for the music heard on this podcast. Finally, thanks to you, listener, and if you like this episode, pass it on, tell a friend. I'm Bill Brio. Thanks for listening.